On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
We are delighted to welcome back to On the Bookshelf one of our favorite historians, William Elliott Hazelgrove. His latest book is The Last Charge of the Rough Rider, Theodore Roosevelt's Final Days. It's from Lyons Press, and that's L-Y-O-N Press. It's so good to have Will back. When we first started talking, your first book had to do with this same time era. So in a way, we're sort of wrapping up a couple of stories that you have covered in the series of books that you've written. Very first one talking about the Madam President, the secret presidency of Edith Wilson. And then we talk about your book, Forging a President, How the West Right. Created Teddy Roosevelt. And now we're talking about what's happening to Teddy toward the end of his life. The more you read about history, this is the great thing about reading history, the more you realize that politics doesn't change very much.
No.
It's a great story of two very different kinds of presidents. And so thank you. Yeah. Thank you for making the story available, and thank you for being with us again today on the Bookshelf.
Oh, you bet.
We have a president whom I admire very much, Theodore Roosevelt. This is a guy who had a very tough start in life and really made something of himself. But by the time this book takes place, the world has changed.
Yeah, the 14th president covered his years out west, which I believe formed Teddy Roosevelt. I believe that's just the essential. Teddy Roosevelt was formed by the 3 years in the Badlands. But I also became fascinated with, you know, a lot of periods of his life were covered, but most historians skip over the final years because, for one, he wanted to resurrect the Rough Riders and charge the Germans in Europe in their trenches in Rough Rider style. You know, they're all on horseback, and they would go charge into these 50 caliber machine guns and flamethrowers and tanks and chlorine gas. And Roosevelt's world, you know, one man could still turn the tide of battle. And as he did in San Juan Hill.
Right.
And you know, most people don't understand that Americans really believed he could do this. And, you know, I used a lot of newspapers in writing this book, articles, editorials, and people believe that, you know, one Western Rough Rider could beat, you know, 50 Germans. And that it didn't matter that war turned into this mechanized slaughter, where, you know, 100,000 men would die in a day, and that, you know, it was death by inches. You know, a few yards, people would go, and they would just be eviscerated. In T.R.'s world, in his mind, it still was the man on horseback, you know, rallying his troops and making the charge and changing the tide of battle. Now, saying that, T.R. also had massive infirmities, you know, high blood pressure, gout, overweight, diabetes, sort of a chronic septic infection that never went away, malaria. His health was broken at this point by his trip down the Amazon, and so he did not relish the idea of just falling apart and growing old. Yeah. To him, the life of action, one way was to go out, would be, you know, to have this final charge of the Rough Riders, and if he's cut down, shot, which most surely he would have been, so be it.
When he was a child, no one thought he would live to be an adult, much less ever, ever get to do any of the things that he did.
Right.
That's one of the things that makes him such a quintessential late 19th century, early 20th century American, because he really did do what people said that Americans are supposed to do, pull themselves up by the bootstraps and go on. About his dad, who was frantic to try to save him from the asthma that he suffered with as a child, putting him carriage at night and rushing through the city to force air into his lungs.
Right.
Because what else could they do? Certainly better than having him smoke cigars and things like that they also did, right?
That's right. I mean, they had no answer to severe asthma. Basically, people would die. They just would asphyxiate. You know, they just couldn't get the air in their lungs. So people would do anything to try and stop the spasms. And as you said, give him a cigar, give him some whiskey, even give him marijuana, give him anything they could to stop these spasms. And of course, none of it worked. So, right, his father was reduced to going out at night when the air was cool in New York. And this is, of course, before massive pollution was in the air.
Right.
And he would have Teddy hang off the side of a carriage. He'd go full speed and basically force air into his lungs. So Teddy Roosevelt had to struggle to breathe at a very early age. And so everything else would be easier for him because he has struggled just to stay alive. And I think it's really informed his personality of just, you know, grit, determination. Of course, his father famously said to him, because he had Crohn's disease, he had all these other things. He was skinny as a rail. And his father finally said to him, you know, you have the mind but not the body, and without the body, the mind cannot go far. So you've got to build yourself up. And so that's what he did. He built himself up. And part of that building up process ended up being going west after the death of his mother and wife, Alice Lee. And that sort of completed that process where he came back this barrel-chested Teddy Roosevelt. So, you know, that ethos of this sort of rough rider, which was actually, and then as you know in the book, I go back to the Western years, because that's really where the rough rider was created, because a lot of these men were cowboys who rode with them in the first charge. And so the boilerplate of the rough rider is a hard-charging sort of cowboy who, you know, will just can do the impossible. And so when he goes to resurrect the rough riders, he goes back to a lot of the same men and recruits new men, but, you know, the model's the same. You know, sort of a Superman that can do anything. And this, and again, the press grabbed hold of it. And then, of course, this is hard for people to believe now, Congress approved him getting a division and taking it to Europe. And it all came down to whether Woodrow Wilson would approve it or not.
Now, this is where the story takes on a turn that most people probably have never heard. T.R. has not been a friend of Woodrow Wilson's. As a matter of fact, the very fact that Woodrow Wilson got elected is partly T.R.'s fault.
Yeah. In 1912, as you said, he decides, you know what, I want to be president again. And the Republican Party's like, no, we've got William Hartaft, he's our man. And Roosevelt says, well, I'm the most popular, you know, man in America. And indeed he was. And so he splits the party in Chicago at the convention, goes down to the Congress Hotel and establishes the Bull Moose Party. And as you know, when you split the party, you're pretty much going to lose.
Yeah.
And Woodrow Wilson would have lost, because Wilson was not a good speaker, not well-known, governor of New Jersey, an academic, sort of a little cold. Taft would have probably just rolled right over him, you know, because Wilson was an unknown quantity, essentially. And Taft was sort of associated with TR. But, of course, TR makes a great run and gets more votes than Taft, but it doesn't matter. And the Republicans really don't forget Roosevelt for that. He's
right.
Sort of a political outsider.
Yeah. You can understand that. I mean, was Ross Perot ever popular after he basically derailed George H.W. Bush's run for reelection? Not so much, no.
That's exactly right. Or even right there, he did the same thing, too, to the Democrats.
Yep.
He came in and said, I'm going to run and all this stuff. And again, these people are spoilers. They're never going to get elected. But T.R. did believe he could be elected. He just thought, you know, I'm the party. I'm it. But he wasn't. And so he really went to political exile for a long time.
This also becomes a huge issue in that he never ceases going after Woodrow Wilson. He doesn't like him. He thinks he's an effete slob and all of that.
Right.
Then he has to shift courses when the Lusitania goes down and all, and he desperately wants to be a part of the next war.
Right.
And because of that, he goes to make nice. And the amazing thing is that this is just T.R.'s personality. He figures, well, you know, this is just politics. It's nothing personal. You know, and he goes to see Wilson, and Wilson's like, I don't want to talk to you, jerk. You know, every time I turn around, you're giving me grief. And now you want to be my buddy? But I love the fact that as you write, in the book, The Last Charge of the Rough Rider, that Woodrow Wilson can't help but be charmed a little by him, even though he considers him sort of a big boy.
That's right.
I love that.
Wilson loves Teddy because, like you said, he had just been lobbing shells at him for years.
Yeah.
And so when he comes back and says, listen, okay, this is all behind us. Bygones be bygones. Wilson, of course, is like, sure. And Wilson's a brooder, you know, and he does hold grudges. So, really, Roosevelt didn't understand that he was really cooked before he began with Wilson. But, as you said, Wilson's a little charmed, and so he doesn't say no right away. It actually starts to progress. Now, the thing is, Wilson's also very much a political animal. And TR is back in the fold with the Republicans. And he is the anointed candidate for 1920 among the Republicans. People see him as being able to run and win. And Wilson knows of this chatter. He knows he's thinking. And so, you know, there's two ways to think about Woodrow Wilson. One is he doesn't want a dead president on his hands in terms of letting TR go to Europe. The second is, what if suddenly the Germans freak out and run from their trenches for some godly unknown reason?
Right.
And Roosevelt survives and can jump up on his horse and say, I just won World War One. And
I did it again.
I did it again, and he becomes back a hero. Even if he just survives, he'll come back a hero.
Right.
So there is that, you know, and there's a lot of people who are like, well, that could happen because this guy is pretty indestructible. And, you know, he's, I mean, and Teddy Roosevelt, I mean, you talk about destiny. There is destiny with certain people. I firmly believe it after doing all these books.
Yeah.
And Teddy Roosevelt was destined to be president and to play the role he played. And you don't know where destiny ends. And so I could see Wilson thinking, what if he survives? Then what?
And, you know, it's so interesting because these are two guys, they do have a little tiny bit in common. They both lost their first wives to the same disease, right?
That's right, Bright's disease,
When Teddy comes to talk to Woodrow Wilson after his first wife has died, there is kind of a sweetness to it. Like, these guys understand what this is like, and this is a huge loss for them both. But yet, but at the end of the day, Wilson is still the president, and he doesn't want Teddy to make political hay out of this. What I like so much about The Last Charge of the Rough Rider, the fact that you're showing that TR really was, I mean, even though he's in his late 50s at this point, he is just beating his body to pieces, and he always seems to overcome things, but injuries leave reminders in your body.
That's right.
I had never heard about this trolley accident that he's involved in when he was president, right? And
that was horrific. Yeah,
yes.
So he's going along in this trolley with his bodyguard and a few other men. And so, all right, so the trolley tracks, the horses are coming down, they're in an open carriage, and the trolley tracks are in the middle of the street, and they're to the right of it. Well, the trolley tracks suddenly swerve right across the horse's path, right? So you're thinking, well, of course they aren't going to have a trolley on it. Well, there was. So when that trolley comes and those tracks go right, it goes right into the carriage. The carriage, you know, is just destroyed. Roosevelt's thrown clear, you know, right on his face into the pavement. And his bodyguard ends up under the wheels of the trolley, just cut to pieces. And the other men are hurt, too. But, you know, Roosevelt, you know, sustains a serious leg injury from that. And this is a time, too, when, you know, it's hard for us to understand medical science at that point, but a lot of what we would see is not life-threatening diseases or life-threatening injuries became that way then.
Right.
Because they couldn't stop infection. They couldn't stop one malady leading to another. And so what happened, people end up with chronic conditions from an injury.
Yeah.
You know, a recurring infection, like, you know, would just keep coming back. And this was Teddy Roosevelt. He had chronic recurring maladies from, you know, the assassination attempt when John Schrank shot him. He had pleurisy, which is inflammation of the lungs.
Mm-hmm.
He had his leg injury from the trolley accident, which had recurring infection where surgeons had to keep going in and scraping the bone, you know, to keep the infection at bay. I mean, you know, they had no antibiotics. They had nothing to really combat the comorbidities that came about from something like a trolley accident or something like that. So you're right. So by this time, all this life of action, all these things he's done, you know, he'd broken his shoulder out west. You know, he'd been falling off horses for years. You know, all of these things come due.
Yeah.
And he's overweight.
Yeah.
You know, Roosevelt loved to eat. And, you know, he saw no reason that you shouldn't eat all the bad stuff you want. We call bad stuff. Then they just called it a good appetite.
Right.
So he would have just prodigious breakfast, prodigious lunch, prodigious, you know, dinners of just massive of quantity. And so, you know, he was probably a good 100 pounds overweight. And he also had, and this is something a lot of people don't know, he had a heart defect of, and nobody's quite sure exactly, but a lot of people think it might have been related to his asthma, where a doctor actually told him when he graduated from Harvard, look, you've got, what, you know, maybe we would call it a heart murmur now or something, but he said to him, look, you've got to live the life of an invalid, you know, because you've got this heart problem. And Roosevelt said, forgot it. He said, I'm going to live the life I'm going to, and if it kills me, it kills me. So you know, that was there, too. There's been speculation he had a rheumatic heart, you know. So he had a lot of things going on in these recurrent, and he had malaria from being down, you know, going down the Amazon.
Right.
You know, which was always recurring.
Yeah.
It was constantly recurring. You know, it was one of those, again, they didn't have penicillin. They couldn't kill these bugs, these pathogens, you know. People just lived with them.
Yeah. When he has disappointments, then he heads on the trail again, and he goes down the Amazon again, or goes to Africa. There is no sitting still for him. You get the feeling that this is a guy who just instinctively knows, if I sit still, I die.
Right, right. And segue into his sons.
Yes.
He all wants to be in the Army, and so they all join up, and Quentin, his youngest, joins the Air Force, which, of course, at this time, you know, we call it the Air Force. It was a bunch of biplanes.
Right.
And these things were crude. I mean, think about this. This is 1917. The Wright brothers flew in 1903. So this is 14 years later.
Right.
Okay. And aviation is not that far along. So basically they're flying cloth wire, some wing struts, you know, an elevator, and a pretty inefficient engine.
Yeah,
and
kites with machine guns, you know.
That's right. That's a great way to put it. And so I think the mortality rate was so high, it came down to like 3 to 5 days just in training, you know, was the average. And so, you know, here's his son Quentin had poor eyesight, a bad back. You know, he wasn't Teddy Roosevelt.
Right.
He wasn't that warrior at all. He was actually more introspective and more of a poet. But he's going to join up. His other sons join up. And, of course, this puts PR on a collision course with his fate, really.
Yeah. I did not realize, until I read your book, that Quentin also suffered from asthma. So when he's flying in a cockpit of these things at 5,000 or 10,000 or feet, it's really cold up there. They're wearing jackets, an open cockpit, and he's constantly catching. The amazing thing is that he got well enough to keep flying, and then he gets sick again. And finally, the odds just caught up with them. And he also was the baby son of TR. He couldn't not engage in somewhat foolish behavior in order to succeed.
Exactly. So he had that hanging over him. And he was foolhardy. I mean, he would go, you know, charging into a formation of Germans. Here's another thing. The Germans have been fighting for years. So these are extremely experienced pilots.
Yeah.
The Americans were coming over there with no experience at all in rickety planes, French planes. And so it was a turkey shoot for the Germans in the beginning. You know, they just kept knocking down the Americans. And Quentin was definitely in that vein of, you know, cocksure that, you know, he's a Roosevelt and, you know, he was going to have his crowded hour, as his father called it, you know, called his moment in battle. And unfortunately, you know, he engages with the squadron of Germans, and he's, you know, shot down.
Yeah.
And, you know, shot through the head. And this really takes the stuffing out of TR.
Yeah.
This really is the thing he can't come back from. Because all his life he, you know, held up death in battle as glorious and courage, and he'd held these things very high. And for him, I think it was a zero-sum game. Well, if I get killed, I get killed. I won't even know the difference. But, you know, if I don't, it's going to further me along. And it did. It's one reason he became president. But he never anticipated, I think, what it would mean for his kids to experience this.
Yeah.
And then to actually lose and end up getting killed.
Yeah. I don't think that's the kind of thing that anybody could come back from very easily. And in the physical shape that he's in the emotional shape that he's in, I knew about it, but I've always felt like this was the last straw. He doesn't live but a couple of months after this.
That's right. And, you know, he understood how ill he was, too.
Yeah.
So I think he really saw this final charge as sort of a kamikaze run.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, literally, he would have to be assisted to getting on his horse. I mean, because he was in and out of the hospital. And as you know from reading the book, he went into basically a fat camp, right?
Right. So
they had some run by some ex-boxer. And I found all the schedule and everything from the newspapers. And, you know, basically it was built around him not eating as much, although basically they kind of said, you can eat what you want, but you got to do our regimen, which basically was sort of a vigorous exercise bike, which was sort of hilarious because the bike was under two steam nozzles. So while you're getting hit with steam, you're on a bike. And you know, he did lose weight, but it quickly came back.
Yeah.
You know, because, again, TR was not that guy to go, I'm going to have a salad. He was never going to be that guy.
Right.
You know, it just wasn't in his DNA. And it wasn't in anybody else's. I mean, actually, to have a big stomach was to say that you were successful.
Right. You could afford to be fat.
Yeah, because most people didn't have enough to eat.
Right.
All right?
Right.
So, I mean, if you look at pictures of that time, okay, first of all, people are very small.
Right.
Because they're mostly undernourished. And by the way, in World War One, when they did the big, you know, 2-3 million men recruitment, they had to reject just hundreds of thousands of these guys because they were too undernourished.
Right, right.
You know, that's where we realized, oh, our people are basically starving.
Yeah.
And you know, there are no vitamins or anything that for them. So, I mean, so when you made it, you had money or you were the patrician class, as Teddy Roosevelt was, you know, to be large, like William Howard Taft or something, was to be wealthy.
Yeah.
To have surplus.
Right.
Know?
One of the biggest killers of Southern men in the early part of the 20th century was a disease called pellagra, which is basically a lack of a critical vitamin that in other parts of the country, they had things that they could eat. But in the South, it was basically eating pork and corn. And that doesn't give you vitamin C or E or anything like that. It was a time when it's hard to visualize what it must have been like 120 years ago or even 110 years ago, that what it was like for people to live then and how fragile life was. That I think the median age of men in America was only about 50 or so. I mean, the fact that TR lived to be 60 was pretty remarkable, especially considering everything he'd been through.
And he'd always said, you know, I'm going to work up till I was 60. He'd always said that.
Yeah.
Because I'm after 60. And so in his mind, you know, he was sort of winding up, you know, and said this would be the fitting epitaph, you know, to go to France and lead the Rough Riders, you know, into the maws of death. And if he didn't survive, so be it.
It really is heartbreaking, but not really surprising if you learned anything about Teddy Roosevelt. It's not a surprising thing that he fought so long and so hard to get his old regiment back together, as unlikely as it was that anybody was going to allow it, and as unlikely as any of them would have survived more than one battle, nonetheless.
It's amazing, and it's hard for people to believe. Now, he had about 250,000 men ready to go.
Yeah.
You know, he was signing up. People were all, and again, the newspapers, you know, big headlines, TR's Rough Riders to France, okay? I mean, the public believed he was going.
Yeah.
And they were encouraging Wilson to let him go.
Yeah.
You know, there are all these editorials saying, Wilson, you know, let TR go. And here's the thing. Let's take the other side of it. Okay, the French were played out. French and English were played out. They had already lost a generation of men. They were just done.
Right.
They were barely hanging on against the Germans. They're, you know, because Pershing's like, just hang on until we get there. But, of course, Pershing had his own shit, and he's trying to get at the men. We didn't even have rifles for the men, you know.
Right.
So it was going to take a long haul to get them over there. So think of it this way. The French desperately wanted TR to come over. They wanted him to come lead this division of Rough Riders. So did the British, because they knew that if TR came, right, first of all, the Germans highly respected Teddy Roosevelt.
Right.
In fact, so much that when war was declared, a German count came to his office in New York, clicked his heels in front of him, and said, you know, basically, I bring the Kaiser's apologies, and we want to know that he hides you in very high respect. So the Germans were saying, you know, sorry, we got to go to war with your country, but we still hold you in very high respect. And so
right.
when this breaks out, all right, think of it this way, that, you know, yeah, a little crazy, but actually not so much. If you sent him over there and with his division of men, and they went and attacked the Germans, it would be sort of demoralizing for the Germans, because first of all, they know, oh my God, the Americans are coming.
Right.
And we just killed one of their presidents. So there's going to be this bloodlust now.
Right.
And then the Europeans know the Americans are in it now. Yeah. You know? Yeah. I mean, it's not that crazy when you look at it that way. But that's also what Woodrow Wilson did not want.
Right. Right.
He didn't want Teddy Roosevelt to steal the thunder. Also, I was going to point out something else. Military establishment did not want Roosevelt to go over there. Because on the first charge up San Juan Hill in 1898, Roosevelt was a pain. He, you know, he was his volunteer force. He criticized the military. He didn't follow protocol. I mean, his charge up San Juan Hill, basically, he took it upon himself to do that.
Yeah, and it's a miracle that he survived it.
Yeah, it was crazy that he survived it. I mean, he was up on a white horse. Nobody else was around him. Everybody's falling from these Mauser bullets. And somehow he survived. You know, it goes charge up the hill, starts this charge, this sort of impromptu charge, and it succeeeds.
Yeah.
And it steals all the glory from everybody. You know,
yeah.
It's like the regular army, it was as if they weren't even there. And there's TR.
Yeah.
And the military did not want that to happen again.
Yeah. It really is a terrific story, and it does have its sorrowful moments. I mean, Quentin's death, the death of TR, his son Archie cabled one of his other brothers and said, "The old lion is dead." And I will say, I think my favorite quote about this was the vice president, Marshall.
That hadn't shaken one to sleep, otherwise there would have been a fight.
That's awesome, really.
Yeah,
really
is. No, and I mean, it is very poignant because, and that's one reason I constructed the book the way I did. I mean, I wanted to give you a ride through his life, a short ride, and build, you know, so you have a sense of his life as he reaches the end. And then, you know, after he dies, it's a small funeral, and which is the way TR wanted it, and it's on a cold, wintry day with snow on the ground, and he's buried up on a hill at Sagamore Hill. And William Howard Taft, who TR was always his hero, even when TR turned against him.
Yeah.
You know, Taft was the last one who stayed there, you know, weeping over his grave. And, you know, it just... People couldn't believe he died, really. They had no idea that he was that ill. And then that little boy who, you know, because Roosevelt used to always dress up and be Santa Claus at the local school in Sagamore Hill.
Right.
I forgot the name of it. And anyway, so they had a little assignment for the kids where they said, you know, write something about Teddy Roosevelt after he died. And so, you know, this one little boy nailed it. And he wrote, he was the fulfiller of good intentions. And so that's really Teddy Roosevelt.
Well, as always, you are a marvelous storyteller, and that's what makes the books that you write so compelling and so interesting. It isn't just a recitation of facts and dry and emotionless. You bring us into their story and make their story part of ours too. So. And that's why I'm always glad when I see this. You got another book coming out, because I think, great, now we can talk about this. This will be very cool. So thank you very much for as always, sending a copy and for making time to talk to me.
Oh, yeah, no, thanks for having me. Thanks for having me, as always.
Every time. And do you want to give your website or anything like that?
Well, yeah, williamhazelgrove.com. And on there, there's a lot of reviews on Teddy Roosevelt and just a lot of meetings. If you go to Facebook, I have a Facebook page, too, on TR. You can just put in my name and it'll pop up. And on there, there's lots of clips. You can actually hear his voice on there. And there's an old film of the Rough Riders.
Wow.
It's really pretty interesting.
Will, thank you, as always, for bringing people to life for us that were so important in the history of our country. And I look forward to the next time.
Thank you. You bet.
Our thanks, as always, to Will Hazelgrove. His latest book, The Last Charge of the Rough Rider, Theodore Roosevelt's Final Days, from Lions Press. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite podcast and your favorite radio station. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.